fly me to the moon. Let me play amongst the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. The reason why I'm still in the game after 30 years, Trish, is that I love the big night. It's nothing like creating a big night and maybe getting a kid up there, especially onto the world level, obviously, but getting a kid to maybe, in a lot of people's eyes, overachieve.
Sure.
And that's the buzz for me. June the 10th, Ponsford, Sheffield, IBO world title, cruiserweight title, Sebastian Rothman. I'm expecting him to go, yes! So I went, quiet. I went, why are you going to say anything? He went, I'm just thinking, I've just better check what road to our lasses on that night.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He said, well, let's pull him back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning and there's nothing else.
Hello, this week I'm joined by Sheffield promoter, manager and jack-of-all-trades Dennis Hobson. As you can tell with that introduction, he is what I say he is. He is a jack-of-all-trades. He has a mean singing voice. You can see and you can hear about the sort of how that runs in the family in this podcast. Before I do get going with Dennis, I just wanted to say thanks for all the feedback to those of you who have bought Damage, my latest book. Some really interesting stuff going out there, and obviously we're getting now to the point where it's been on sale 2 or 3 weeks, so a lot of people who've started it are now coming to the end of it, and the feedback's been really humbling. And thanks to people like Matt Dickinson, Thomas Hauser, Matt Christie, it's a really long list of people who have given it the time of day. Rick Broadbent, Don McRae, some highly established authors in their own right, and some of the top journalists working in the world today, Thomas Jabezi as well for Ring Magazine. I know I'm leaving loads out. And also to those other podcasts, so some might call them competitors. I wouldn't necessarily call them competitors. I think we all occupy a slightly different space, even if we cover the same subject matter. But huge thanks to Teddy Atlas, to Matthew Macklin and Andy Clark, to Jake Wood and Spencer Oliver at Pound for Pound, to Ed Draper, to Bryn John Butler for Ring Magazine and their podcast. All the guys that have had me on recently, I really appreciate it and the opportunity to talk about the book and to talk about Damage. And like I said, thank you very much for those of you who've bought it. If you haven't, please try and check it out. I think so. It's priced at £22. I believe it's down to £18.56 on Amazon as of today. That generally means, I'm led to believe, that it's doing really well, because when book prices go down, that shows that the people selling it recognise that it's doing well, so they drop the price to try and sort of make the most of the on the activity that's being done in the marketplace. So hopefully it's doing well, but more important than that, hopefully it's helping some people. In fact, I've already heard from some trainers and some fighters, both in the UK and in the US, and they believe it will help them and it's changed their outlook. So that's been great to hear. Back to Dennis Hobson. I've known Dennis for a number of years. I don't think we massively crossed swords when I was at Boxing News, but I covered obviously a lot of Clinton Woods' career, and Dennis was there and thereabouts. You can look up my interview with Clinton Woods in the Boxing Life Stories archives here. I think we were probably around episode 30 with Clinton. Perhaps one I'd like to revisit as well down the line. But Dennis was great. I think, you know, we've spoken a lot, but this is the first long conversation Dennis and I have had, and I really enjoyed it. So much new information in here for me, and obviously you get to see the levels Dennis has been at with the likes of Clinton Woods, but also working with or against the likes of David Haye and with Ricky Hatton, Jamie McDonald, Stewie Hall, and so forth. Some really interesting stuff. Before we get to Dennis, I just want to thank, as always, the sponsors of this podcast, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but Hanson Lee help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety and Compliance, who are a leading provider of professional fire, asbestos and safety services to businesses nationwide. They offer one expert point of contact for all of your fire, health and safety compliance needs, and you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. And now here's the brilliant Dennis Hobson.
Dennis, thanks for having us around. It's great to see you. What was the dream then when you were growing up? I mean, obviously you're involved in boxing, you're managing, promoting, all sorts. Is boxing where you were always headed?
No, I mean, if you want a bit of the life story, and I'll get through it as soon as I can, as quick as I can, is when I left school at 15, I had qualifications, and I wanted to be a chef, and then decided that wasn't for me, and then ended up working on the markets, didn't make any money doing that, and then my dad had always made a lot of money out of a scrap metal business, but I didn't want to ask him for anything, so I went and lived on the markets, lived in a little 10-foot caravan, came back not earning anything, and I thought, I've got to get back into something I know, and I was still playing football at the time, and I'm a decent footballer, played at semi-pro level, so obviously through sport, as you know, you meet a lot of people, so I could always add up, one for whatever reason, I could always add up, so I thought, I've got to get into doing some buying and selling, I thought, well, let me have another pop at a scrap metal, but I've got no vehicle, and all I've got were a ground, because my dad was a compulsive gambler, and one thing he did buy me was a greyhound. So I thought...
Is it a dog?
Yeah, a dog. And I used to go around the flapping tracks and sometimes the NGRC tracks. And this greyhound, it were a great, fast out of the traps. He called it Hellaby Black. But it didn't quite get the distance on some tracks. So an ex-footballer, Terry Curran, he played for Southampton, by the way, in his career. Lovely fella, stays in touch with me now. He offered me £250 for the dog. I thought, well, I need to buy a pickup so I can go out around the engineering metal companies and try and knock on the door and buy the metal. Hence, that's what I did. Sold the ground and bought a pickup. And that's how I ended up in the scrap metal business, which has been my core business. Played football all my life. Had one or two amateur fights. Always kept the boxing going from, because I walked into a gym about 13, 14. But I wanted to be a footballer. The boxing, like I'm doing my little girls now, it had an effect on me because I didn't want to be... My dad's called Dennis as well, Dennis Hobson, and he's very, very well known around Sheffield. And I thought, I want to make my own name in my own right. But what am I going to do? I want to be a footballer. If I can't be a footballer, I want to make it, you know, in business on my own. So I didn't know what I wanted to be. I weren't trained to be a doctor or anything like that. I got no qualifications. But I could look somebody in the eyes and shake their hand and stand on. And I've always been honourable that way. So when you do that with one or two people, the word travels and you get a good word, a name for being, your integrity being good. So that's how I managed to get on in the scrap metal business. But going back to the boxing, I sometimes used to get my boxing mixed up with my football on the football pitch. But I've always got that winner's instinct and winner's mentality. And it sometimes overspilled, we get a bit too overexcited, but I suppose it's just having a winner's mentality, and you can't win them all, Trish, as we know, but I've won a lot more than I've lost in everything I've done, and I think that's, I've managed to pass that on mentally when I was doing stuff like with Clinton, when he came training with us, and I think I'd, not just to get him the best, build him up technically, mentally I worked on him, and I thought, if I do this, I wonder, that might get the best out of him. I was trying things with Clinton, and obviously certain things worked because we were a great partnership. So, you know, I mean, I'm jumping a few years, but I took a couple of years out of football to have maybe put my toe into the water and had two or three pro fights. But I always like to get in the steps. I always like to get it on the end of the user. And I've got respect for any of the kids. And I always trained all the way up, and I still go down our gym now with John Fuchs and sometimes do a little bit of sparring. I've done for a bit, but as I got a little bit older, obviously I'm in my 50s now, but when I used to go to the gym, I used to have a line on the wall, and the line got lower with the kids who were allowed to spar with me. So that's how I worked it. But I love it. I love being around the kids and seeing if I can just pass a few little tips on to them. And my thing in life, and we are leading off, is positivity and and have a can-do attitude, because you put the news on, as we have obviously this last year and a half, and it's all negativity about this and the other. And I think in any situation, you've got to try and find a positive. And you know, I try and surround myself with as many people these days who have got that kind of attitude. And when you're trying to get going in the pro game, Trish, you sometimes have to, you know, work with people who you don't necessarily like and agree with and stuff like that. But I've got to the stage where I don't have to deal with people I don't like. But obviously, you come across people who you aren't your favourite people, but you still do business with them, especially in the boxing game. But the reason why I'm still in the game after 30 years, Trish, is that I love the big night. It's nothing like creating a big night and maybe getting a kid up there, especially onto the world level, obviously, but getting a kid to maybe, in a lot of people's eyes, overachieve.
Sure,
sure. And that's the buzz for me.
You mentioned your dad. He was involved in boxing, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. My dad was more of a street fighter, Chrissy, where he's very well known for his attributes on the street. He had started in doing a bit of promoting. My dad did his own little bit, because my mum and dad got divorced when I were about 14, 15, and I didn't see much of my dad for years, saw him off and on, and so that's why I said I never used to want to ask him for something, even though I love my dad. I just wanted to go and do my own thing. But as he got older, we come together and we were inseparable, and he loved the boxing nights, and sometimes he used to help me get involved with the boxing and do a bit of promoting with me.
What do you think of you getting into the scrap metal game then?
I think my dad just wanted me to make my own way. He were in the scrap metal in a, within the scrap metal industry, there's different fields, if you know what I mean. He'd got a big business, and if my dad hadn't been a compulsive gambler, he'd have been one of the richest men in Sheffield, if not the richest. But my dad could not have done his money in if it hadn't been for gambling.
What was his vice? What did he gamble on?
Everything.
Horses.
He could not win. Well, yeah, at one bit, my dad had 50 grand. He owned 50 grand. But he'd bet. He loved the race, the horses. And he'd be sat in the bookies. He'd get up, he'd do his business, earn a few quid, and think, right, I've got to get in bookies. And he used to have one or two bookies. And if he couldn't get out of the shop, he'd be at home. He'd have the sporting life, and he'd be on the blower to two or three different bookies who he had accounts with. And there used to be, like, in Sheffield, there's Ollerton Dog Stadium. And I remember as a kid, I had my first bet when I was about 8 years old. So I'd got it in my blood. I'd have ended up being the same. But fortunately, I ended up with not having enough money. And then I found football and I found boxing. So that took my focus away.
So do you not gamble at all?
Oh, yeah, I like a little flutter, but
How much would you say a little flutter was? So say you were betting on a horse race.
I might just have 100 or 200 quid on. And my dad had thousands in. Thousands and thousands.
On several races a day.
He'd bet on every race. You can't win.
No.
He loved, and he don't, gamblers only tell you about the wins.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not
you see that on social media, everyone posting their win slips.
Yeah, exactly.
No one posting their losses.
Exactly. So everybody wants the pat on the back for winning, but I loved the ground race, and I went all around the country with ground racing. But no, I'm fortunate that I lost that bug for it, and I can take it or leave it now. But I love to have a flutter, and I could soon get into it, because I've owned a racehorse with someone for, and I had a little dabble in that, and it wasn't an expensive one, but
what was the name of the horse?
Friday Four Ball. Okay. Friday Four Ball. We got four runs out of it, and they were holding it back because they said it weren't ready to really go and try and win a race. Held it back three times, and then they said, right, this next race, we're really going to go for it and try and win it. It went lame. We got a big vet bill, never raced again. So that was my little stint in the horse racing, owning a racehorse. So that's not for me, but look, when you go into business, you're having a gamble, aren't you? And
sure.
What I'm doing as we speak is a calculated risk, but it's something I love and it's a passion.
Well, yeah, when you talk about, obviously, people in the pandemic and having a tough year and a half, and then you talk about people thinking outside the box, and that's something you've tried to do and showed, firstly, with the new app,
mm-hmm.
and then also with your tear up in the car park.
Yeah.
which was a great idea. So, funnily enough, I went to my first ever drive-through cinema in the first lockdown, and actually sent Eddie Hearn a picture, and I said, this is what you should do. And he said, I've looked into it, and it's not probably the right sort of crowd. And I don't know, I didn't do, obviously, any market research, but I thought the idea was there. And then a couple of weeks later, you announced it and said that you did it. I mean, how was it? Obviously, it was great for the pros who could get out.
Yeah, it was great for the pros, and it was just doing something that's not been done in this country, and we did it in with a bit of style, a bit of polish. It wasn't easy to do, and I'm one of them, Tricia. I remember, can you remember a matchmaker called Graham Lockwood?
Yes.
You'd pay him to matchmaker, and he used to talk to you like he was your school teacher. When you were like a little, weren't he? And he go, Dennis, you can't do that. No. I go, Graham, I don't want that match for Clinton. I think it's a bit too short. You what? It shouldn't be boxing if you can't take on that kid. I go, can we do it next time? I used to be scared to ask him in case he made an earful. So, anyway, so I was, remember ringing him up one day. I went, Graham, I fancy having a go at boxing promotion. I went, Dennis, what are you dreaming about? He went, you can't do that. I went, that's the worst thing you could have said to me. So then we had a go, and I remember being on the back of the coach, going to watch Sheffield Wednesday at Ipswich on a night match. And I said to my pal, I fancy having a go. And he were a nightclub owner. And I said, I fancy having a go at this boxing. He went, well, how are we, Dennis? He went, look, I'll sell you a few tables. And we did the first show at the Octagon Centre in Sheffield, and Glyn Rose were the top of the bill.
Okay.
And so that was the first one. So that was my first stint. Then I got the bug off, I can do this bigger and better. And then Clinton walked through the door, and me and my pal were training, my dear friend Neil Port were training at the time, and we took him under our wing, and obviously had no idea what were going to be in front of us, but it was a long journey. And to be honest, Trish, now if he walked through when I ain't got the contacts of what I've got, it'd be very difficult to achieve, because I wouldn't probably have the energy. All the time.
All the patience.
And the patience. And so, but it's all part of the story. And to be involved in this game, you've got to have got a passion for it. It's not like any other industry. It's not like, if I wanted to go and make a few quid in the scrap metal, I know I can go and bid for metal, and I know where I can sell it. I find my market first. You sometimes make decisions in this game, like football, in the football industry that you do, where your emotions get involved a bit too much, and you make sometimes decisions which aren't sometimes financially beneficial to you.
The gamble.
It's a gamble. Gambling, I've got it in my blood, the gambling, and I will probably till the day I'm not here still take little gambles, because it was what floats my boat.
Are you involved in other businesses aside from scrap metal?
Yeah. We have an engineering company. We make components for aircraft and the oil industry, which has been the worst hit
of
the pandemic. But we'll be fine. We've got a good team down there. And it's, look, I'm not an engineer, but I'm not bad at putting people together.
When you say down there, where?
The south side of Sheffield.
Okay.
And if I took you down there, Trish, you'd be quite impressed, because we spent a few quid on updating everything, and it absolutely looks the part now.
Where do the jersey links come from?
Well, one of the few holidays I went on with my mum and dad before they got divorced was Jersey.
Okay. St. Helier?
Yeah, we went to St. Helier. We stayed in a place called La Place Hotel, which is in the parish of St. Brollard's.
Oh, yeah, no, by the beach.
No, that's La Homme.
Oh, St. Brollard's Bay, is
but there? But St. Brollard's Bay Hotel. There's the Lorizon and St. But so the hotel that I ended up buying shares in was La Place Hotel. So I own shares in that now. I'm a third owner of that now.
Okay.
As I am La Homme Manor. So I went over there about 2003, fancied a change. I wanted to put a boxing show on there because I'd been over a couple of times to the amateurs there and got to know quite a few people, and I've got some really dear friends there. Ended up asking how you could get into Jersey, because there's restrictions as regards
the tax and all the rest of it.
Yeah, and so they were an opportunity for me to purchase a property, which was in a company, So I don't actually own a property, I own a company. So I bought that and I still own that property now. So then I got met a couple of partners there and we bought into these two hotels apart from, we'd done some development as well, building houses. Okay. So I invested in that and I've still got some investment there now. So, you know, I am spread a little bit thin and both my little girls were born there.
Right.
Because I've been married before. That's my first daughter, who's with Simon Cowell there.
Yeah.
She was in, she got a Britain's Got Talent semi-final.
Okay.
And
What was the talent?
A singer. She's a great singer. I had her, you know.
Oh, she did Ricky's National Anthem?
Yeah, when she was 15 years old in Vegas.
Yeah.
And she sang the National Anthem. I've got Wayne Rooney carrying the belt, if you remember.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got Robert Williams sat here. And I'd sent the England band over. You know, there's only one, Ricky Ann. And I got them going in and out every casino up and down the strip. And just to create a little bit of, you know, I'd done my job with Ricky Ann. Me and Ricky are very close getting there. And it was just a shame they went out and did the Mayweather.
Yeah, we'll get onto that. But when you talk about that show, mm-hmm. The Octagon with Glyn Rhodes, yeah. What was the dream when you set out? Because like you said, you could never have predicted what would come over the next few years. So what did you want to achieve? Was it just one show at a time and see how it goes?
Well, if I use Clinton as an analogy, is that I didn't know how good Clinton was going to be. So I thought, there's so many fights with him. We'll get to a level and hopefully he can go on and fight for an area title. And then we'll take stock and see what we're like and see if there's improvement. And I think in the promotional business, that same sort of principle where I have in my mind. Do a few shows, see what I'm like at doing it, see how good I am. And then you never know, I'd get bigger and better fighters and track bigger and better fighters. And what took me to the next level, I think, was I'd put a few shows on and Tommy Gilmore approached me, and that was through Graham Lockwood, and he said, do you want to put a Paul Silky Jones fight on for us in Sheffield when he fought Vernon Phillips?
Okay, yeah, Vernon Phillips.
Because Silky were training down with, his trainer. Can't remember his trainer anyway. They were training down, so I'd better sell it out, and we did. We put a smashing show, we put everything together. I got paid peanuts by Tommy and Barry, but it was just, I thought, I'll get that on my CV.
Yeah.
I've put a world title promotion together. Obviously, with Airtel, the television and their promotion, but in association with us. So that was on my CV then. So I thought, well, I've had a little taste, then let's see where else we can get to with this. So it was just a... You know, nothing definitely planned. Nobody giving me a platform to say, look, that's where you are. It was just like being in this game. I did it on my own as regards selling a greyhound to buy a pickup. Yeah, and people knew I were, but there were certain times where I didn't want people to know there were Dennis Hobson's son in Sheffield. Sure. Because I thought, I want to be able to go to bed at night and know that I've done something myself.
And so your dad, was he... You obviously talk there about him being sort of respected. Was he feared, respected, or was he...
Yeah. But my dad was...
Was he a good guy or was he a villain?
My dad was an absolute gentleman. He always looked after ill people and kids and whatever. But my dad just used to want to fight.
Right.
And anybody who could fight, he'd fight him.
Was he a loose... So he was a bit of a loose cannon?
Not a loose cannon, no. He got a fantastic brain.
Yeah.
He got a fantastic wit. He got a great voice, sang every day. He wasn't a loose cannon, no, he was a very, very smart fella. And he was probably a little bit of a womaniser. But he was so charismatic.
Have you got a good singing voice? Or did it skip a generation?
Do you want a bit?
Have you got something?
Fly me to the moon. Let me play amongst the stars. Let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter and Mars. How's that?
Nice. That's good. Was that ever an option for you? Have you done that?
No.
Some good cruise ships with your name on it.
Well, there's been one or two. By the way, every time I go on a cruise ship, I leave Sarah, my missus, and I go and find a piano bar. And I go and pal him up, give him a couple of whiskey and say, look, I'll be in to see you later. I want Mr. Bojangles when I enter the room. Brilliant. And now I'm going to fly me to the moon. I'm going to do a bit of Elvis and I'm going to be a Elton John for you. You're honest. And he writes them all down. He just wants it. Go, hi, Dennis. And then he puts my ass on. He goes, do you fancy coming and join me, Dennis? Come on, then. And then I sit next to him. Brilliant. So that's where I am.
That's great. So it didn't skip a generation.
Well, my dad would have got a great voice and he knew all the words to probably 3,000 songs. And he was such a charismatic fellow, honestly. He'd walk in here. Michelle can't get anything done. I call her Miss Moneypenny. She can't get anything done because my dad would be singing, telling stories. And his stories, you know, I'm telling you something about my stories, but my dad's stories were captivating. And like I said, he were a street fighter, but there were always a bit of fun element to what he were doing. He got absolutely electrically fast hands, my dad.
Talking about fast hands, there's a poster up there of Roy Jones and from the Clinton Woods fight.
Mm-hmm.
When you had that fight with Clinton, did you think that was possibly the pinnacle? Because obviously Roy was pound for pound number one, the best fighter in the sport by a mile at the time. Did you think that that was as high as things were going to get for you boxing-wise?
I suppose so, because how can you get involved in a promotion, anything bigger than the pound for pound best in the world? So, you know what I mean?
Promote the pound for pound best.
Well, yeah, I suppose, yeah. But, did you know how I made that fight?
Go on.
So I'm doing business with Panos at Panic's Promotions, you know, when he got...
Panos Eliades.
Yeah. And Clinton got to be the number one at the WBC and had been waiting for like 18 months now. Roy had got all the belts, if you remember. Apart from Mikkel Cheske,
right,
the WBO champion. So there were never no chance again as into Germany. I thought the only way that we could get a shot at the world title, and I, like I said, I didn't know how good Clinton could be, and I thought, well, Clinton fans is having a go, let's go and have a go and see where we get to. And it's a tall ask. Anyway, I'd gone down to see Panos in London. I said, Panos, Clinton's been waiting 18 months for his world title show. Dennis, baby, we're gonna still make it happen, I promise you. And I went, Panos, I'm going to go and have a pop myself. I said, I promise you, and you've got to shook his hand. I says, if I make a fight with Roy Jones, I'm giving you a percentage because you've backed us on so many of his fights. And I kept my word on that, by the way. And I rang Clinton up, and I'd been in touch with Brad Jacobs, who were representing Roy Jones at the time. And he was fighting Glenn Kelly, you know, where he puts his arms
behind his back. Yeah, Australian, yep.
And I'd run Brad Jacobs up and says, Brad, and you know sometimes the Americans, they talk as though like we're just their little brothers. And I says, Dennis Hobson here. Hey, Dennis, how you doing? And this, that, and other. And yeah, would we be okay for a couple of tickets? So I'm talking to him like a little lad. Yeah, I'm sure we can find you a couple of tickets for the show. And you know, Clinton's on the list, but, you know, we'll get to you. We'll get to you as though like, yeah, be quiet and be a good boy and I'll give you a couple of tickets. So I said, I rang Clinton. Clinton went, yeah. And he weren't the most eloquent or a great speaker, Clinton. So I goes, have you got your passport? He went, yeah, well, I went, we're going to Miami. And this were on the Tuesday, we were going to Miami on Thursday. He went, all right then. So I gets over to Miami, I guess us booked into the fight hotel, met Glenn Kelly and Kevin Kelly and all, Jeff Fennick and all that. So the fight happens and Roy does that bit where he goes behind, arms behind his head and clips Glenn Kelly, doesn't he, and he wins the fight. So I goes and purposely in the press conference went and sat at the front before anybody came in. And the room, as you can imagine, when Roy had done his fights, it were absolutely a massive audience and it were just buzzing. So I've sat at the front, Don Majeski were there, Claude A. Brown's were there. So he's talking and some of the journalists were shouting, hey Roy, just want to say what a privilege it is to be in the room with you, such a fantastic human being. Me and Clinton were like that to each other. So it's about. Anyway, so they're talking and he's just nursing his wounds, Glenn Kelly. So I thought, and I says to Claude, I went, tell him Clinton Woods is here. And Don Majeski says, tell him Clinton Woods is here. They all looked at the feet. So I thought, what am I going to do? You've come all the way to Miami and nobody's going to know we've been. So I thought, bugger this. Went Clinton and I got him in a suit. I dragged his suit and went, Roy! And everybody looked at him and went, Clinton Woods is here. he wants to fight, and I threw him on the stage like that, I swear. and Roy was brilliant. He went, well, come at me. There you go. He's in the mic. Everybody went off Glenn Kelly and looked at Clinton. Clinton went, well, I fought all the rest, and I beat the rest. Now I want to fight the best and beat the best. I thought, where's that come from? I can't believe he'd come out with this. So, and he went, you lied about everything. By the last bit, I'll fight you, man. Claude went, they'll fight you now. He says, anyway, the New York Times the next day, he said, a kid from the UK called Clinton was Roy Jones, agreed to fight him at his last press conference. And that's how the beginning, and we had obviously the legal bits of going backwards and forwards, sure. And I won the purse bid for that, because they didn't want to pay us enough, so I entered into a purse bid. Then Lennox was suing Panos, and then he introduced me into the litigation, saying I was just a front for Panos. So nobody should enter into any business dealings with me, because I'm just a front for Panos. So nobody would buy the fight off me. So with me and Don Majeski, what we managed to do was say to the Roy Jones people, to Brad, he said, look, we've got the fight, but we're going to go to Showtime. Now, we know he'd got a contract with HBO, so he couldn't fight on Showtime. So, but we'll agree to sell you the fight back if you give us the money, which is our cut out of the purse bid. And that's how we got Clinton extra money out of that.
Did you think Clinton had a shot against Roy?
I believed in Clinton, and honestly, at the end, I mean, we what had happened where we got Clinton with a trainer, and I'd gone out there, we'd sent him out too early.
Who did you get him with? Which trainer?
Ian Olcott.
Okay.
Now, Ian, smashing lad, but more of a conditioner for me, and he overtrained Clinton. Clinton overtrained for the fight. I'm not saying he'd have beat Roy Jones anyway, but when I finally went over, I'd gone over with a head cold or something, so I didn't go near Clinton for a few days. And when I went to the gym where we were training in Portland, because originally Roy were going to come here, I got Brad Jacobs, he flew over to look at the Sheffield Arena and Wembley Arena for us to do the fight here. Anyway, because Nike, they're in Beaverton near Portland, they sponsored the show, so they threw more money at it, so he ended up going to Portland. And so when I gets over here, and eventually when I felt all right, I went into the gym and watched Clinton sparring. He'd got cold sores all over, all his muscle definition were there. He's overtrained. So we went, stop training. But you know, not doing no sparring. Andy Lowe was sparring. Remember Andy Lowe?
Yeah.
Andy Lowe had come over here to spar when they were in Sheffield, and Clinton were gaffering him. Over there in America, Andy were gaffering Clinton. So he'd got nothing in him. So for like 3 or 4 days, I just told Clinton he just got to rest. So we've got a little bit more energy back in him, and all I'm asking him to do now is do no more sparring, he's just going to pad work. So his preparation wasn't the best, but Roy Jones at that time was unbeatable. But Clinton, as he come out, I mean, I threw the towel in, I don't know if you've seen that, when I threw the towel in for that fight. And Roy, I spoke to him the other week, about 3 weeks ago, and he said, if you remember, Dennis, I were asking the referee to step in as well. But I went, I forgot what the court referee or a referee were a big lad. I threw the towel in, and when Clinton goes out, I went, you're right, Clinton. He went, yeah, he enjoyed it. Good lad. But I suppose because he got that much trust in me, I'd like to think so, that he knew I'd only let him take so much punishment.
Were you with Clinton to the end?
All the way through, yeah.
There were two very close fights with Glenn Johnson, a draw and a loss.
Mm-hmm.
During that period with Glenn Johnson, it looked like it wasn't going to happen, didn't it, for Clinton? Like,
mm-hmm.
He was just on the... He just couldn't quite get over the line, could he?
Mm-hmm.
Did you think that, or did that just reaffirm to you that he was actually world-class?
I thought, you know, when you get a loss, is it sometimes... Some people, like myself, will class it as a learning or a loss, the L. And I think the loss with Glenn Johnson, if we'd have done the same thing... And he'd have got in with him again, he'd have lost again. And so we had to do something different. So we tweaked one or two bits, got him a little bit of extra experience. We changed his nutrition again. And then we got over the line with it. But, you know, the big one was obviously the Rico Hoy fight.
Yeah, so that was like his big breakout, wasn't it? Because Rico Hoy was kind of like, I can't remember, did it come before or after Jeff Lacy? But he came over with that kind of reputation.
He did.
It?
And then Clinton, I mean, I won the purse bid. I think that was with Gary Shaw. Gary Shaw. He thought he'd done me in the purse bid. He was playing a game with me. And I remember being in Jersey. And he said to me, I'm saying, like, what's it going to take for bring the kid over? I offered him about, I think about $100,000 or $80,000. And he went, I think you're going to have to pay a little bit more than that day. So I went, okay. I says, well, how much? Anyway, it got to the day of the purse bid. So we're 5 hours in front. I said, look, Gary, are we, can we do it? I think you're almost there. So I thought, he's playing me here. Meanwhile, I've already sent my bidding. Okay? We've done with Jesse. He's already got my, we've already got my envelope, or he's already waiting for my envelope. So I thought, he just thinks he's playing me. He went, Dennis, let me come back to you in an hour or so. I think we might be there if you give another $15,000. I went, okay, Gary, no problem. Anyway, never rang me back, did he? My bid's already going. He tried to get me dangling so I weren't putting a purse bid in, so he won a purse bid. Lindsay Tucker is, do you mind if I swear on you?
No, go for it.
I goes, Lindsay Tucker rings me in. Dennis, Lindsay Tucker. I went, hey, Lindsay, how are you? Congratulations, you've just won the purse bid for the light heavyweight championship, the IBF light heavyweight championship of the world. I went, thank you, Lindsay. That's tremendous. He went, but hang on, Dennis, there's somebody who would like to speak to you here. Dennis, Gary Shaw. I went, hello, Gary. You owe me. I went, how do you work that out? I went, I put a lesser bid in so you could win the bid. I went, Gary, you thought I was a mug, didn't you? And he says, no, you don't understand. I went, understand this. Fuck off. And I put the phone down on him. That one, he tried to play me. But that's sometimes one of my dad's great sayings. Is the wise man can act the fool, but the fool can't act wise. He thought I was a mug.
That's great stuff. The Rico Hoy fight, obviously, it was Clinton's coming of age. You got Rico over here. How satisfying was that night? Because, you know, again, Rico was supposed to come here and bash Clinton up.
Well, we'd just lost our close friend, Neil Port, at the time, who were a big influence on Clinton and me. We were very, very close. And I don't know if you've seen the pictures we got, a picture of Neil. And I don't know, I'm not a religious type of person, but I do believe in a bit of karma, me, Trish. And I think it was just meant to be. And the training went tremendously well. The camp, the sparring, and it was like he was impregnable that night. It were his night, and it was just special.
Yeah, did he expose Rico Hoy, or was it just sensational that night? Or
I think a bit of both. I think a bit of both. I think he probably destroyed Rico mentally because of the job he did on him.
Probably doesn't get the credit it deserves that night, does it?
I don't think so, because I think on that form, and that's when I did try to do a deal with Frank, with Calzaghe, and Calzaghe is one of my favourite fighters from these shows. I think Clinton had a trouble Calzaghe on that form.
Clinton, with the title, grew as a fighter, didn't he? He improved his win over Jason Delisle, stopped him quicker. He twice beat Julio Gonzalez, who was probably one of the most underrated light heavyweights at the time. Mm-hmm. And then he finally got over the line against Glenn Johnson.
Yeah.
In a third close fight. And I mean, even to have three close fights with Glenn Johnson, who obviously would then go on to beat Tarver and Roy Jones. Glenn is, you know, just shows Clinton's class to have three life and deaths with Glenn Johnson.
Yeah, because people have come up to me and say, you know, because Sheffield, to say it's a big city, is a village as well. And people say, Dennis, how come Clinton's not as well known as Calzaghe? Well, Clinton Wall don't like to go meet and greet. He likes the quiet life, like Salisbury. And then he hasn't been like a top class amateur. He came into the game not late, but not straight out of the amateurs winning titles as an amateur. So he wasn't very outgoing, so it's hard to beat the drum for him. So, and when I'm trying to get him to meet and greet, it was difficult. But so underrated, Clinton. Nobody fancied him when I asked him, well, where do you think he can get Dennis? I went, he's roaring to. I went, there's something, he's so much more to come out of him. And we believed in him. And obviously that's why I went to the ends of the earth to try and prove it. And I didn't know, the exciting bit, Trish, was I didn't know how good Clinton could be. There was no limit to how good I thought he could be. But I thought, well, when we get to that level, that's when I'll know. I didn't know, but I thought he kept improving. I thought, there's more to come here. There's more to come. I thought he could win something big, but I didn't know how big.
You mentioned the Calzaghe fight. Was it ever close?
Yeah.
Did you have serious discussions with Frank?
Yeah, well, when we fought Glenn Johnson, he won the purse bid on that.
That's right. Yeah.
And I bid for it. I didn't know Frank was in for it. But he'd done a deal with Leo Mongolese.
Mongolese, yeah.
Yeah, and so I thought, where's that come from? Anyway, it was put on in Bolton. They put us in a broom cupboard like this.
I remember Clinton telling me that, actually.
And I got Rick, because I just signed Ricky at the time, so I thought, right, he would only allow us three in the corner, wouldn't let his dad come or anything, have any tickets. So there were a bit of a discussion with Andy Ayling, my good pal Andy Ayling. He had a little bit of verbal that night. But Clinton were never fazed by any of that. Clinton just thought...
He was motivated by it, wasn't he, I think?
Well, if anything, yeah. I thought, well, they're trying to get me beat. But Clinton were more to me. He thought he needed to level things up with Glenn Johnson. And because he'd had, like you say, when he won the world title, he grew a bit more as a fighter. And so they never invited us to the press conference, so I gatecrashed that. And I took the pee a bit with Frank. And, you know, I can't help it. I like a little bit of nonsense. Anyway, I'd got Robert Davis, my solicitor at the time. And Frank had got in touch because, obviously, they thought that Glenn Johnson were going to beat Clinton. That's the reason why they bid for the fight. And Calzaghe, Glenn Johnson coming together. But so I goes down to London to meet Frank with Ed Simons and give me one of his little handshakes, Frank. So it's not a really solid handshake, is it, Frank? So right in. Where are we? So he goes, so I said to Clinton, what will we take? So we'd agreed on a figure of 850 grand, what we'd take the minimum. So I'm sat there with Robert Davis. So I went, right then, Frank, I can promote this, but obviously Joe's the bigger name, and you've got the platform, I can get it on a platform, but come on, I'm not silly, make me a bit. So he went, well, I can't get the good American TV and I can't get the big name because Clinton's not a big enough name, blah, 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 blah. He went, go on in it, mate. He went, 600 grand. I went, do me a favour, Frank. I says, am I brand new? He went, nah, come on then, where do you want to be? I went, 1.2. He went, nah, anyway, backwards and forwards, we does a deal at a mil, and 150 up on it. So I shakes his hand. Right then, the contracts will be with you in 4 days, the fight's on. So I was, one more thing, Frank. He went, what? And I went, on some training expenses, why are you trying it on? And he went, well, we've just done the deal, you've just shook on it for a mil. I went, some training expenses with what sort of money he's talking about. I went, 25 grand. He went, 25 grand. So I'm just about to get a coin out of my pocket. And he went, tell you what, I'll toss you. Devil a quit, 50 or nothing. I went, Robert goes, Dennis, I'll give you 10. Don't. I'll give you 10 or 15. I went, shut up, Robert. And he went, call. So I'm just looking in like that. And I thought, I love all this, don't I? He went, call. I went, heads, with tails. Robert went, oh, fucking hell. So I went, well done, Frank. That's all I didn't give a fuck. And I very thought, is he weighed up right? Or so I've just lost the toss for 50 grand, haven't I? I goes outside. He went, anyway, then the fight's down and we did it. So I goes outside and Robert was smearing. Dennis, I can't believe what you've just fucking done. He'd have given you 10 or 15. I went, why do I want to take 10 or 15? He knows when I blink. I says, he'll never know when I blink. Because I'll never know where I blink, so I'm definitely not going to let him know where I blink. He went, yes, but I'd have still took 10 or 15. I went, well, you do what you do, and I'll do what I do. Anyway, Calzaghe pulled out of that. He went and fought Bernard Hopkins, and I left. We had a fight. I flew over because I used to get on really well with Ken Hirschman. Remember Ken Hirschman?
Yeah, Showtime, yeah.
Well, he were at HBO before Showtime. Oh, sorry, he were at Showtime and then went to HBO.
That's right, yep.
And because Gary remembers that purse bid, he wouldn't deal with me. So with Ken Hirschman, who brokered the deal with Antonio Tarver.
Okay. So Clinton lost two of his last three, Tarver and Tavoris Cloud. The one he fought in between, I think it was Mariki in Jersey, wasn't it?
Yes.
Cloud was a beast at the time, but I remember speaking to Clinton and he was being trained by Richard Poxon at the time, ahead of the Tava fight, and they were over there, it was in Florida, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And things weren't right when I spoke to them on fight week, and it seemed like it just gone tits up even before it started. Were you aware of that?
The problem what happened towards the end, because Clinton used to, he'd ring me up if it were raining, asking me what clothes to wear. What do you think I should wear today? Because he hung on every word I said. And as we got going, and look, my history with boxing isn't great. I've got my thoughts of him. But I introduced him to the boxing game, Richard Poxon. And so I stuck him in to train Clinton. But Clinton were already established then. But one thing about Richard Poxon was quite organised, but he'd never had a fight in his life, so he sometimes don't know how kids tick mentally, and I did, but I'd lost a bit of Clinton because Richard was there with him, Poxon, and Clinton were like thinking he had to come through Richard to get to me. I think that's what happened, and I lost that bit of connection a little bit, not 100%, because he didn't want to bother me. I thought, oh, no, Dennis is so busy. And we've got, and he's doing bits with Ricky and stuff like that. He probably got that. So I lost a bit of the connection. So I didn't know until we got to Orlando, that's where we were staying. And I had to sit down with him because I could tell mentally, and a couple of his pals said, Dennis, he's not as positive. And I sat down with him. I thought I'd lifted him, but not enough. He'd got a negativity in, because when they do the you know, the interviews before the fight for Showtime.
Yeah, the fight meetings and stuff.
And one of his pals went in with him and says, Dennis has just made a very strange interview saying, I never thought I'd get to this kind of level. I shouldn't really be at this level. Saying words, things like that.
I think that's what he said to me on fight week in the boxing news preview, yeah.
He'd never been like that, because even when we've gone in small hall shows, we met Toomey in Hull when he were at the bottom of the card, it'd be like... I'd walk him out and I thought, you're number one here, you know. You're a class act here. And he'd only had a couple of fights. But he'd got that bit about him. And when he fought you, Glenn Johnson's and people like that, he got that little bit of an edge. With a Tarver fight, and he's never, ever made an excuse. But I won't read his book, because there's one or two bits in his book aren't true. I know they're not. And I don't like some of the things that he's put in the book, because it's not true. It said about him having a bad back, and he knows if he was in such a bad way, I'd have called the fight off no matter what. Because it was like I was still paying his private healthcare. That's how much I thought about Clinton. He were on my family healthcare, even up to about 3 or 4 years after he retired. So the Tarver fight, that was a disappointing one, because I thought that was where we were going to break America. I got Ken Hirschman from Showtime saying, Dennis, if he's just in a good fight, I want to do a 3-fight deal with you. Mm. So I'd have got him a lot more money for the next 3 fights. But he just didn't turn up. He was a shell.
He was just passive, wasn't he?
There was nothing in there. And he was standing mid-range. He weren't even close, or he weren't long. There was nothing there. And the sparring, Poxon didn't go over and get the right sparring, and the camp wasn't good enough mentally, with a big thing with Clinton, because if Clinton had been there mentally, I think he'd have got the Tarver. I think he'd have been too, he'd have done a job on Tarver like he did Crawford Ashley. I think he'd have got to him. I think he might have been outworked and outboxed early on, but I think he'd have been too strong and too eager for Tarver at the Rick O'Hoy Clinton was.
Did Clinton ever get that hunger and desire back?
No. No.
What was it? He hit the mountaintop and was satisfied and sort of lost that desire, as fighters do when they get to that high level, and exceed their own expectations?
He never travelled well. He went over the States 2 or 3 times and never came back with the goods. I just wish we could have done the Calzaghe fight, because I think it would have been a lot closer than what people think. And if it had been at home, and I think I lost him a bit. I think I lost Clinton. I think I lost his mentality a bit, because we got such a great connection. When we first started, there was me, Clinton and Neil. And when Clinton got Richard Poxon involved, I think that was the wedge a little bit what came between us, we, you know, not saying we fell out or anything like that, but I think Clinton could have beat Cloud. I think they were a bit more in Clinton to beat Cloud if they'd have had the mentality, because Cloud ended up going to hospital. I know he hit Clinton with some big shots, but Clinton ended up winning the last couple of rounds. But a Clinton Woods of like maybe 2 years before that beats Cloud all day long for me.
Are you and Clinton on good terms now?
We're all right.
He's done all right out of the game, though, hasn't he?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's people like Robin Reed, who were arguably a lot bigger name than Clinton, who lives in a mortgaged up terraced house. Clinton lives in a £750,000 house. He's got property up and down the road, and he owns his own gym, and he's got a business. So if that's not success, when I first set out, I thought, if I could get Clinton to be a millionaire, what a dream that'd be. That's when we started. That's before we won a British. So we've done that more, haven't we? So, and I did used to advise him. I look after his money, and in that respect, I'm very, very humble that I've helped him create that. And obviously, it goes down in history. Our story is fantastic.
You obviously mentioned Ricky a little bit ago. Why did Ricky choose you over everyone else? Because he came to you when he was red hot after the Costa Zoo fight.
Because he sang a song after he won the Costa Zoo fight, and it was a Frank Sinatra song, and it went like this. It went, "The best is yet to come, won't it be fine?" No, he didn't. His dad rang me. He went, "Dennis, what do you think? We're leaving Frank. Sky wants us to go with Barry. And Barry wants us to... we want to do the Mousify, the unification fight." And I said... and he said, "But Barry wants to keep all the gate receipts." He said, "Because that's got to go to Mouser. He wants 1.2. I went, 1.2? That's not right. I went, "Why don't you let me do it for you then?" I says, "I tell you what," I went, rang him, I went, "I'll get you an extra $300,000. I'll gamble, I'll get you an extra $300,000. He went, and you know what, pound note raise all about. Pound note. So he goes, anyway, Kathy Dover rings me. Oh, sorry, I rang Kathy Dover. She went, "But Dennis, you're not his promoter. Why, you know, Barry Earns is his promoter." I went, "No, he isn't." So I rang Ray up. I went, "Ray, you're not going to get this fight done unless you put it out there that I'm your promoter." I said, make me your promoter for 48 hours. And he went, ring Kathy Dover up and tell her I'm your promoter, and I'll make you that fight. So I'd already got two other kids in as plan B. So anyway, I rings Kathy Dover. Also, she rings me, she went, "Dennis, I'm hearing that you're Ricky's promoter. Is that correct?" I went, "Yeah, that's correct." That Barry was going to give us 1.2, and that's the sort of purse we're after. I went, "Well, Barry's not his promoter, is he?" So I said, "Look, let me just tell you, it's $500,000. And what you're going to get if he defends his WBA title against anybody else? $50,000? "Well, yeah, I suppose." Says, $500,000, Cathy, and if you want somebody else on the undercard, we'll look after you with that." Anyway, I did it, did the deal, got him $300,000 extra, and then they asked me to do the next three fights with him.
What was that stage of Ricky's career like? Enjoyable?
Amazing.
It was Mauser in Sheffield, Collazo in Boston, Arango in Vegas, and then Jose Luis Casillo.
Right, I didn't want to do the Collazo fight. We'd got on the list, we were fighting Juan Lascano, and he got injured. So HBO have a list, and we're getting $3 million from HBO, and obviously with the Sky money, so you were adding up to a nice little package for him. Now, we got working with a fella called Art Palulu in the States, who were playing his part in the States. I won't say too much about that because it didn't work out as well as I wanted it to. But anyway, the fights were... I remember we'd put a show on. I put a show on with Robert Waterman in Monaco, and we'd had Matthew on there, and we were sat in a hotel room. Juan Lascano's out. So the two fights what were left on the list was Vivian Harris and Collazo if he moved up. I didn't want to fight Collazo. He was southpaw, slippy southpaw.
Bigger.
And we're going to the States for the first time. So we're supposed to be going to the Connecticut, Foxwoods, Connecticut. Yeah. That never materialised. That were our Palulu was supposed to be pulling that off. So that never materialised. So we ended up going to Boston. So I wanted to fight Vivian Harris, but they didn't want to fight him because Junior Witter at 40. So, anyway, we just got through that, didn't we?
Yeah.
So,
Raven, it was soaking, though, wasn't it?
Oh, soaking.
like what we've had here.
Like what we've had here. So I could say, so Ray rings me up and he says, Dennis, we want to go back down and fight for his IBF title. So you can imagine I'm getting slagged off because he's had to relinquish the IBF and the WBA after that great win, and Hobson's come along and he's had to relinquish his title. I didn't want to, I wanted to defend him. Anyway, Fires collapsed, so we had to pay a step aside to what we call the German. The German, anyway, who were in line to fight Colazzo or Ricky. Anyway, we relinquished the WBA. So we
could not okay, Urkel, was it?
Yeah, Urkel. He made a right few quid out of step aside.
Did he? Yeah.
Anyway, so Ray rings me, wanna fight Urango. So I went for his light welterweight belt. So rings HBO. I says, we wanna go back and fight Urango. He's not on the list. I mean, we won't be taking that fight. So I rings Ray up. Ray, HBO won't take that fight. They're saying, go back to Manchester, and when you're ready to resume your HBO contract and the list, what we set out. So I went, well, we'll take a lot less than Dennis. So, but we want to fight him. So anyway, I won't tell you the figures, but I did a great deal because I rings Bob Arum up because I'd been a watch. I went to the Castillo.
Corrales.
Listen, Corrales was signing with me, by the way, 6 weeks before he passed. So I've got him lined up to fight Ricky after the Castillo fight.
Wow. Okay.
So big names, but well beatable, sure, for Ricky, because sure. Ricky had been too strong for him. So, because I thought, we'll build the brand. Don't go after Mayweather yet. Let's build the brand so it's massive, and then, you know, like Bob did with Pacquiao, kept him in.
Yeah, and obviously if Ricky did a big job on Corrales, then obviously it's comparable results with Mayweather and Corrales, exactly, as well.
So that's what my plan was. So anyway, I rings Bob Arum up, because we'd gone to the fight where Castillo didn't make the weight against Corrales. Okay.
Yeah.
So they were at 135. We knew we could make 140, because he weighed in at 140 for the 135 limit. So we knew we could make 140.
yeah, for sure.
So he goes, rings Bob up. Bob, it's Dennis Hobson. Hey, how you doing? I was, Bob, I know Castillo's suspended and he's got fined. Will Castillo fight Ricky, man? Fuck, of course he will. I went, right. I said, you've got to help me help you here. What do you mean? I went, we're going to create the semi-final for the final. I says, we're going to fight Urango. You're going to fight on the same bill. And then we're going to fight each other after. So, but you've got to let HBO know that. Okay, I'll speak to you tomorrow. Anyway, he rings him, I rings him. We're back on. He gets the extra £3 million in the pot. He gets paid for Bernard. So then I gets him a lot. Two, three times more than he thought that he was willing to fight for Urango. And then obviously the semi-final. And Castillo almost got beat on that fight, by the way.
Yeah, I remember.
And then the big one was the Castillo fight at the Thompson Mac.
How good was that Castillo night?
Oh.
Was that the biggest and best night of your career?
Yeah, I mean, because you've got somebody like Ricky, and you, when we first went to Vegas, we were a fellow called Joe Shaw, tallest Mexican I've ever seen, very smart, immaculate. He was the entertainment side manager for all the eye rollers, the big gamblers. He used to make sure they were looked after and stuff like that. A big boxing fan. Hey, I've heard you're in town, Ricky, and anyway, this is my promoter, Dennis Hobson. Ricky were promoting me. He were telling, so he went, why don't you come up and meet the guys in the office? So we were upstairs in the offices at HBO, in the casino. And I'm sat around the table. Ricky's telling all them how good I am. I'm like, he was an absolute dream. Dream. He's telling them, because they're thinking, who's Dennis Hobson? I'm not Frank Warren, I'm not Barry Ayres. And he's telling them what a job I do. So it were a dream, and I had a lot of fun because I'd have a little spa with Ricky and speakies there, and we had a lot of fun. So, but at the same time, I remember little things when he fought Castillo, Matthews fighting, and then Billy Graham's in the corner with Matthew. Ricky's supposed to come out next, so I'm sat at ringside, and HBO saying he's got 10 minutes and he's out. I went, no, I mean, this. So I went to Ricky, and Ricky's heard that he's got to come straight out. He's got, Billy's not here to warm him up. So I thought, I don't want him panicking, worrying. So I went to the change room. I don't know if you can see it on TV. I walked off from ringside, and I went into the change room, because Ricky usually has all the music on, and he was sat there on his own. I said, Rick, I went, all right then. I went, yeah, I went, you're not going out until you're ready. You know that, don't you? I went, you tell me. I says, F, HBO, when you're ready, when you're sufficiently warmed up with Billy, I'm standing at that door, whether they've got to extend their programme, you're not going out until you're ready. I went, you're right with that? I went, sound. So little things like that. I mean, I had a plastic surgeon waiting when he fought Unification, Mouser, in Sheffield.
Yeah.
And he got them terrible cuts.
Yeah, sure.
I had a plastic, and if you watch after, he didn't get cut too bad after that. The plastic surgeon did an amazing job. I had him waiting for Ricky. So there were little things I did. I didn't get, look, I'm involved with boxing. We all want to be successful, but we've signed a lot of fighters now, Chris, but I'm not in the game just for being a promoter and having a number of fighters. Unless I've got a connection and I can have the crack with you or whatever, and I feel, then winning something don't feel the same for me.
Obviously, that Castillo night was huge. That was the one where your daughter sang the anthem, right?
Mm-hmm.
The national anthem. And it looked like things were going to get bigger and better, and he fought Mayweather next, but you guys parted ways. And I've seen some, just looking through some archive stuff, of you were making offers to Mayweather to come over here. For, I think you offered him $5 million to come over here, but regardless of what was going on at the time, you stopped working with Ricky then. Were there hard feelings with you and Ricky at the time?
I don't know about those. Yeah, there was, because I didn't want to fight Mayweather. And I don't think that story's exactly accurate, that we offered him $5 million to come over here. I think there were millions getting thrown about for which TV broadcasters, Satanta or Sky, were going to take, and Sky wanted to do a pay-per-view. I didn't want to take the fight. And then Ray had rung me up and said, Dennis, you're our UK promoter, we want to fight Mayweather. I went, and I'd known they'd gone and done a deal behind my back with Golden Boy. And I didn't want to do the fight, because Bob had rung me up, Bob Arum. He said, Dennis, don't let him fight Mayweather. I went, Bob, we're not fighting Mayweather. I went, well, I'm hearing they've done a deal already. I went, because I says, we've shook hands, we've got a deal for life. I'm family to them. This is what they're telling me, Ray and Carol. And Ricky kept out of it. He left it to his dad. And so I didn't want to fight Mayweather. So we'd got a deal, and I was going to do a three-fight deal with Bob, where we got Ricky like $25 million minimum for three fights, not fighting Mayweather. So I didn't have to fight the best. I didn't have to fight Pacquiao. We were going to build the brand. That's one great thing that Bob's brilliant at. That's why he's been the best promoter for decades, because he's a shrewd fella even at his age. He knew he didn't want to throw Pacquiao in with Mayweather early doors, because he's lost his golden goose and he's building that brand. And I think that's how he saw Ricky, and that's how I saw Ricky. We build the brand, and then when we're ready, then let's get it on. Don't do it too early. The brand hasn't grown big enough. But they wanted to do it, and you know, there's different stories on the reason why it happened. But I was disappointed, and I walked away. I was very disappointed, and obviously it weren't just because I got a connection with Ricky.
Where did you watch that fight then? Hatton Mayweather.
I remember what do you call him? Jeff Powell writing
for the Daily Mail.
Yeah, yep. Writing an article about I should have been there and stuff like. He wrote a lovely article about me, and as if to say, like, they hadn't done the right thing. I watched it at home, and obviously part of me, you can imagine, when you feel a bit aggrieved, you think, half of you, there's a little thing wants him to get beat, then because of how much I thought about him, I thought, I can't help it, I want him to beat him, even though they've done the dirty. I thought.
Did you have a flutter?
No, I didn't. I won't do it on that, because there were a bit too much emotion, and I were a bit, not bitter, I were upset, because I'd put a lot of stuff to one side to do the right thing for Ricky. And if you think about it, while Ricky was with me, arguably, you could say he had the most successful period of his career. He won another world title there, another world title, Colazzo. So Mauser, Colazzo, and Castillo for the IBO. So, and a new Rango. So he's won world titles in every fight again with me. So I think I know Frank did a fantastic job with him up to the Costa Zoo, and the timing of Costa Zoo. But the timing of the Castillo fight were fantastic as well.
I've seen, there's obviously over the years been a lot of pictures of you and Stewie Hall. How good was the Stewie Hall ride?
Stewie Hall ride, it with the achievement, it's not ended as well as it could have done, because there's some people, they forget what you've done for them. And I think I helped change Stewie's life, because
he was a big time clubber, wasn't he?
Yeah, and the reason I got involved with Stewie Hall, I didn't really like the kid, because he'd come over to fight Jamie McDonald, and he got a bit of an attitude, a bit of a swagger, and I don't mind a bit of a swagger. You've got to have a bit of a swagger sometimes in this game. But he wasn't the most likeable kid, and I'm a people person, me, Trish, and I really took to Jamie, and I were plotting his path, and I just didn't take to him enough. When Jamie fought, I thought, I don't like him. Anyway, I was big pals with Mick Marsden,
okay,
his trainer and manager at the time, anyway. And Frank Maloney had stopped promoting him and stuff like that, and he was coming off a loss. He said, Dennis, can you help me with Stewie? And I said, I'll try. I went, I'm not right bothered about him, you know, Mickey. I said, but I'll do it for you because you're my pal. Anyway, I got him on the Jamie McDonald world title fight. And I'd got him a kid called Sergio Perales, is it? Sergio Perales, for an intercontinental IBF. So I thought, get him a position in the IBF. Anyway, I got him moved up to number 5. I helped lobby for him to get up to number 5. Anyway, when the JMA did walked away and signed with Eddie behind my back, broke his contract, when I'd done my brains in it, the keep mode in Doncaster, but I'd got a bit of a deal with Jordan Boy, because we were going to chase Leo Santa Cruz.
For Jamie?
Yeah, but Santa Cruz relinquished, and that's why I got the vacant title with Julio Cesar. Well, he was matched up to fight Leo Santa Cruz in LA. I didn't fancy that. So I said, what happens when you... Are you going to move up? So I'd asked them when they were going to move up, and he said, well, we're going to move up after this fight. I said, well, what if we step aside? Okay, so we stepped aside, and he fought somebody else, and he went good to the word. They relinquished, and that's when we got in for the vacant. So I'd done all that bit of manoeuvring for Jamie, and then when he went off and went behind my back and did the deal with Eddie, obviously I weren't too happy with Eddie, and I expressed that disgruntlement in Atlantic City with Eddie to his face one day. And then I managed to get Stewie in for the vacant title.
So you mentioned, obviously, we've talked briefly a little bit about Frank and Eddie in this. Do you get on well with, let's start with first, Frank?
I respect him, and I've had some pleasant meetings with him.
What about Eddie?
Eddie, obviously, I didn't like what he did to me with Jamie McDonald, but when my dad passed, he sent me a lovely message. And I respect him for that, and he showed a bit of class by doing that. He's done fantastic. Same again, I don't think he's in the boxing for the same reasons that I am. And we all want to make money in anything we do, I suppose, but I want to do the right thing as well.
Are you impressed with what he's done with this global expansion and the big deals in America? And, you know, he's got Canelo, he's got Joshua.
Obviously,
He's done some big stuff.
Oh, amazing. He's a great salesman. And if he were a double glazed salesman, I think he'd do very well at that. I arrived at the right time. He's got a great platform. His dad's when I had an argument with him, he says, look, my dad's a genius, and I had to agree with him. His dad's given him a fantastic platform, but he's gone on and grown and learned from it.
So you've mentioned this you and Eddie swapping words in Atlantic City. Was that about Jamie?
Yes.
Did you give him both barrels?
Yeah, called him a prick a few times and a cuckoo. And you know what cuckoos do? They don't build their own nest. So I said, go and build your own nest like I have. And says, you know, I don't have to have my daddy provide me with a nest. I built my nest myself. And he said, well, I had a couple of whiskies. Look, it was war under the bridge. I says, anyway, me and you were going to have a pop anyway, Eddie. And he says, well, I'm not bad, you know. He's about 6'7".
He's not 6'7".
Whatever he is, I don't know. He's taller than me anyway. So I said, he's still not going to last long with me and you. And I was all a bit tongue-in-cheek, but I was still like, but I've got to have a pop at him because from your own
self-respect.
Respect, yeah. And but like I say, when he sent that lovely message about my dad, it redeemed him a lot. And still don't agree with what he did. And Jamie, we're no better off. He ended up having to go abroad in some cracking fights and earn himself some good money. But with me, he'd have earned the same money, if not more. And his brand would have been bigger.
Because he was here. Retired a week or so ago. Have you spoken to him at all?
No. It's a shame. I mean, he used to be in his office every week, a couple of times a week, coming and having a cup of tea, having a crack with us, because he was good fun. Mm. I took him to WBC conventions and all he wanted to do. On the way over, I've introduced him to the staff on the Virgin, and you can sit at the bar, and all he wanted to do were booze, and I kept saying, I'm having a snooze. Jamie, have a glass of water, and then we'll let you have another one. It was just a booze bag, and when he got to Vegas, he was a booze bag. He's just a lad. I remember going to, my favourite fighter is Sugar Ray Leonard. I remember we're just coming out of the lift. Oh, he was just coming out of the lift. And I'm with a couple other guys and we've got Jamie there. I said, oh, Sugar Ray Leonard there, Jamie. He went, where like? He didn't know who he was. I says, best of all time. What ain't he good like? And I went, Sugar Ray Leonard. He didn't know who Sugar Ray Leonard were. He didn't know if he were any good. He went, I'm not a boxing fan, am I? But the kid could fight, couldn't he?
Sure. The promoting thing, it's tough, isn't it? It's a tough gig.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's not easy. People look at you. You can't win because the outside public think that promoters are mercenary. Yeah, some promoters get other promoters bad names. It's a thankless task because they either think you're stitching somebody up or you're making bundles of money. And, you know, there's people like me, Carl Greaves, Steve Woods, Kevin Marie and people like that, and Mo Pryor, we'll throw a few quid just to get our kids out there, and if we break even, we're happy, and you're looking for the bigger nights. So, if you know, without television, it's almost a thankless task. But you know, some people make a few quid out of the game, but they manage quite a few fighters, and they get some decent sponsors. But as a business, it's not the best business in the world because it's, you know, sometimes you're dealing with the public and sometimes you're dealing with people in boxing who aren't business people, so they don't quite get the logic of business.
And then also sometimes you deal with business people who aren't boxing people, absolutely, particularly TV network executives.
Exactly. So you get people come into boxing who want to reinvent the wheel. Well, I thought this is what you should be doing. And they come and go. Well, I've stood the test of time. I'm still here. My missus has wanted me to pack it in before now, but even though she loves it, she'll say, well, why? You've nothing to prove. But she loves this concept, but she don't want me stretching myself too far.
Sure.
But, you know, I mean, I'm in for the achievement. The achievement first, make a few quid after.
So just tell me about Fight Zone.
Fight Zone was born out of us, me and three partners, bidding for Box Nation. We got a whisper that Box Nation was going to be for sale. I think the administrator, I forgot what the status of it all was at the time, but it was something like an administrator had put it out there among certain people to see what they'd bid for it, debt-free. The Ice family were calling time on the debt and the company wanted to walk away. But to do that, he had to sell the company on. So we were led to believe that we were the highest bidder. So we bid two or three times and we got to what we needed to be the highest bidder. So that's where we all were. We thought we'd done the deal. And then obviously Frank had still got some sort of... And I smelt it. I says, Frank's somewhere still involved in Box Nation. and they've done a deal with Premier Sports.
Right.
And Premier Sports have got Box Nation, but with caveats. So that's now not how we wanted to work. So that's not the way we wanted to work. So we decided, let's have a go on Arrow. And here was born Fight Zone. We wanted to take Box Nation off the linear platform because it's a very expensive way of doing television. And we wanted to put it on the OTT, which like DAZN is, you know, Netflix, Amazon and all companies like that. So we thought there's a hole in the market. And if we can, we wanted to work with different promoters, and that's the concept of Fight Zone. We've got good relationships with a lot of promoters, and Sky, BT or Box Nation, as it was when Frank was there, why couldn't you do deals with promoters and let them put the small old shows on? Yeah, you did some of the big stuff, but you can have them as the academy shows. And there's going to be one or two great fights amongst them, the area titles, English titles, whatever, will pop up. Now, that's what we're creating, but we're working with the promoters who can have dates for themselves, put the shows on. Obviously, we've got to have a standard, and the standard will be like the production, and we'll want to oversee who's on the shows to see if we want to take the fights. But the promoters we're working with, at least if they wanted to come to us and say, look, I want to put six shows on Fight Zone, we'll give them a platform and come and film it. And if there's one or two of them kids where they want to get to a level, and instead of having to go to Frank or Eddie, we'll sit round the table and maybe discuss maybe investing in some of these fighters with them.
Of course, we've got, but would that have happened without the pandemic? Or do you think the pandemic sort of expedited everything?
No, that was happening before the pandemic. Okay. Yeah, it's the pandemic that's held us up. And
right.
And that's the reason why we've done the straightening the car park, and that's why we're doing the car park shows as we speak. So it's not ideal, Trish, but you know, it's a lot easier to do shows inside. But you know, I'm somebody, I suppose, who don't want to be beat and find a way or explore or exhaust any other avenue to go down before I say no, it's not doable.
You did do some David Hay fights back in the day, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I did.
Did you do the Carl Thompson one?
Yeah, do you want that story?
Go on then.
So Carl, a lovely fella, Carl.
Yeah, priceless.
So humble, and I really took to Carl. So he'd retired, he got beat by Johnny Nelson, very bitter about it. I think he thought he got stitched up, sure, even to this day. So when I'm with Ricky at the time, I thought, I haven't got Ricky at the time. I've got David Hay we're all working with. And obviously Clinton, and some of his people had come over and said, Cal's interested in doing a bit again, Dennis. Do you fancy doing it? Yeah. Anyway, put him in two or three fights. He looked too bob. So I thought, anyway, yeah, let's just keep having another. Anyway, I think, what did he fight after? Before Sebastian Rothman, fought somebody anyway. So I spoke to Robert Waterman, and we'd been in touch with Rodney Berman, and about him fighting Sebastian Rothman for the IBO world title. So, very broad Bolton accent, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Cal. So I'm really excited, because I really took to Cal. Absolute lovely man. So I'm right excited. We've got the world title for Cal, so I ring him up and Carl! I went, yeah? I went, it's Dennis. I went, hello Dennis, how are you? So I went, good, Cal. I went, I've got some exciting news for us, Cal. He went, oh yeah, what's that? I went, forgot what day it was, I said June 10th. June the 10th, Ponsford, Sheffield, IBO world title, cruiserweight title, Sebastian Rothman. I'm expecting him to go, yes! So I went, quiet. Cal went, yeah? I went, why are you going to say anything? He went, I'm just thinking, I've just got to check what road to our lasses on that night. Carl, it's a world title. He went, I know it should be alright, but I'm just going to check to make sure she's not on the outside now. So anyway, so obviously we make the fight, and like I'd said to Richie Davies that night at the weigh-in, I says, Richie, because he hadn't looked brilliant, I went, give Carl every chance, because he's an ex-kickboxer and sometimes he stands square on, I says, and sometimes his balance is not brilliant, it looks as though he's going and he ain't quite going. So he goes, okay. Anyway, I don't know if you watched that fight, Trish.
Yeah, of course.
But
yeah.
He was just toying with him, weren't he? And he was just smiling at him, Rothman, and I'm thinking, what have I done here? I'm going to get slated here. Anyway, he possumed him a couple of times, if you watch it. And Richie Davies said to me after, he goes, Dennis, he went, he went, you know when you said to me, give him every chance, I was just about to stop the fight. He said, and I stood back, I thought, I'll have another look, and he went, bosh! And he goes, boom, straight into the canvas, didn't he? He's dead into the canvas. I must have jumped like a salmon. I was as fast as that ground, into the ring. I lifted Carl up, and only you'll see me, I absolutely sprinted into the ring. Anyway, obviously, that was a big buzz. So then I gets, Adam Bull rings me up. I remember walking on the prom at Jersey. Very well spoken. Hello, Dennis, it's Adam. I went, hello, Adam, how are you? He went, well, yes, you're our promoter, and you're Carl Thompson's promoter, and in the contract it says you've got to give us the best fights available. I went, yeah. Well, we want to fight Carl for the world title. I went, okay. I says, well, great fight. And as a promoter, I says, yeah, great. And I'd love to watch it. I says, but do you want me to give you, put my manager's hat on? Yeah. And give you a bit of advice. And what I see as advice. He went, oh yes, what's that then? I went, you don't want to be fighting Carl Thompson. Nope. Yeah, but we want to fight him for the world title. And I know, and I'm going to make it. I said, but he's too dangerous for David at this moment in his career. He went, yes, but we want to make that fight. We want to fight for the world title. I went, well, please remember this conversation. And obviously, the rest of it is true, isn't it?
That's great stuff. I've got some questions from subscribers. Chris Bartram says, would Eddie Hearn have made such a success if he had to start from scratch without the Matchroom Money machine and Sky contacts?
Probably as a double glazed window salesman, yes. But look, I don't think he's an out and out boxing man. I'll be honest with you. I respect what he's done. It's fantastic what he's done. But for me, he's not in the game for the same reasons. And if it was a music promoter, I think he'd be a success at that. But I think it just so happens that he got thrust into the boxing industry. And he's made a success of it, but I don't think he's an out-and-out boxing man.
By the way, boxing is not your sole business. Would you like to be in that position where it was?
I've been a scrap metal merchant for just about all my life, and I've always wanted to diversify. So, I'd like to be, and that's what we're trying to achieve now, where I'm a bit more involved, and we're doing show after show, where I think I can pass the experiences I've had on, maybe help build big and better shows and give a lot more kids who don't get opportunities. Because I love to watch any level boxing. So I suppose, yeah, I'd like to be doing it to a degree full time, but I'd always have to have a lot of business interests.
Andy Moyes asked here, and you touched upon Jamie McDonald leaving, joining Matchroom. Andy says he thought it was a kick in the teeth and wondered whether you patched things up. You've already addressed that. And then he's also asked for your thoughts or experiences of working with Hatton. I suppose that's got to have been the hardest thing, is it, people leaving?
Yeah, I mean, I can stand a lot of stress. I think I need a bit of stress, like some people say, you know, you don't. But we don't want too much stress, but it's people. I can stand for business deals going wrong, but when somebody looks you in the eye and they shake your hand and they tell you like we're like family and we're brothers and we're honourable, I take that as gospel.
People will say, look, you know, you and Clinton, so-so now, Jamie's gone, Ricky's gone, Stewie indifferent. It's you. You're the common factor.
Why would you not think that? Because you know what my dad says, give people a position of power or give them a load of money, then you'll see the true person. And I've created one or two monsters. Why has the White Rhino come back to me? Why has other fires wanted to come back to me? It's like I said, sometimes the kids, people get in their ear. Me and Ricky are solid. again. His dad got in between us, but me and Ricky are very, very close again. So Jim McDonald, if he come in here now, you'd see he probably want to put his arms around me. He regrets leaving. But they chase the money and keep using sayings, but my nanan used to tell me, den, money is the root of all evil, love. And because my nanan were a communist, she wanted us all to have the same amount, but obviously it doesn't work.
No,
but
sure.
My nanan used to be in the Communist Party, but she was in love with the ideal that we should all have the same. Which is lovely, because I could take you two down to my nanan's house and she'd open the door, get what you want out of the pantry, love, get what you want out of the fridge, and do you want to drink? She'd give anybody anything. That's what my nan's. But it's true, money changes people. And that's what's happened with them kids.
But you got a few quid. Has it changed you?
I'd like to think not. I mean, because I think what it is with me, Trish, I grew up watching Laurel and Hardy. I've seen my dad. I've gone from when my dad started to get a few quid, went to live in a nice house. Then when my mum left my dad, I'd be back in the tin bath. So, literally. So I went to back up and down. So my life were up and down like that. So I think expect the unexpected sometimes. So I've probably had that mentality that sometimes things aren't forever. And the thing I think most people will hopefully say this, is I don't take myself too serious. I want to have a laugh every day. I want, even though I might get stressed, but I want to try and sing a song, as much of a song that I know, every day. And I want to have a bit of fun. And I think if you can put a smile on somebody's face, I'm going to get the best out of you, whether it's singing, playing football, boxing, or in business. And that's how I made a living in the game, I used to have a pocket full of readies. I'd knock on a door, and I'd say, any chance of me coaching for you? Waste metal, scrap metal, and can I put some skips in? Oh, sorry, pal, we have a contract with somebody. I said, yeah, but what about if I pay you a bit of cash? And I start telling them some boxing stories, start telling them some football stories, and I go, right, do you want to deal with that boring bastard who you get a little bit more money off, or do you want to have crack with me? And I'll give you some readies. Let me get back to you, Dennis. And that's how I got on.
Did you ever see Sinatra live or not?
No, I'd have loved to see Sinatra.
Is that, if you could have seen anyone live, would it have been him?
Absolutely. My dad loves Sammy Davis Jr., yeah. Frank Sinatra,
Dean Martin,
and go on, who else? Tony Bennett. Loved all them. I took my missus to see Lady Gaga, and she's doing a bit of the jazz.
Yeah.
And she's done the duets with Tony Bennett, hasn't
That's
she?
Right, yeah.
I love all that. I mean, I love music, and like I say, you know, my daughter's a great singer. Music, another one of my dad's sayings, my dad were a tough, hard man. And he'd say, Den, they'd call me Den all the time, music soothes the savage beast. Which is true, don't you believe?
Yeah, I think it certainly has its purpose.
I think it does. I think play a bit of music, I think you can bring people from who's on the ceiling, bring them down a bit. I think music has that impact. And everybody needs a bit of music, but you've got to be able to have a smile and a laugh at any time, because, you know, there's too much negativity about it. And so whatever we're doing, and look, this is a serious business. Kids can get hurt. So like I say, we want to do the right thing. But say I was signing you to fight with you as a contract, and for me to manage you, Trish, the last thing we'll be saying is we'd already done the contract, so Trist is one more thing. You go, oh, what's that? We've got to have a bit of fun along the way. That's the condition. If we're not, I don't want to know. Because I want to be able to have the crack with you. Let's go and win something, but let's have a little bit of fun at times as well.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much, Dennis. Really appreciate it. It's been brilliant.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's tough, man.
So I thought Dennis was really colourful, really interesting. So many good stories, obviously not a bad singing voice on him to boot, and I thought a good sense of humour there too. Really enjoyed that chat, loads of new information there for me too. A reminder, this podcast is brought to you by Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do they find you the best people, but Hanson Lee help you retain them. and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, who are a leading provider of professional fire, asbestos and safety services to businesses nationwide. They offer one expert point of contact for all of your fire, health and safety compliance needs, and you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. Thanks for joining me. Like I said at the start of this podcast, if you haven't had the chance to check out Damage, please check it out. You can see it. You can get Amazon. You can get it via Amazon. You can get it via Waterstone. I think Barnes and Noble in the US have it now. So please give it a look and let me know what you think. This podcast, Box and Life Stories, has an Instagram page and a Facebook page, so you can check us out on there for more content. Huge thanks to everyone who's tuned in and listened, and we'll be back next week.